Maybe this is the point to widen it out to the audience. I think we have a roving mic here, which may or may not work. Oh, you've got one there.
This one, listen.
I think there's a lot of areas there that I was intrigued by. One was particularly, you were talking about novel-like openings at one time, and we seem to be shying away from the whole question of faction and fictional biographies. Not shying away, it just didn't arise. Though I think it is interesting, the overlaps of novel and biography, and also the question of the power of the biographer. I don't know if you ever felt at some time you had the power to condemn or, I mean, particularly you were mentioning the cases where we're talking about the little girls, and also the vexed question of the death of Freudian slip of Jones's first wife, where I did come away with the feeling that you actually did believe in some guilt there. Now, obviously, there has to be a sort of psychoanalytic reading here, but on the other hand, you're writing for a non-analytic audience. And did you feel that you had his the verdict in your hand?
No,
at that point?
Never. No, I'm not a psychoanalyst, and I tried to put the facts down. There were no, I mean, as with many things, there aren't the facts that only lead so far. Mm-hmm. And I, on the question of the school children and his guilt, I just, thanks to your archives and all, I put it all in chapter 4. Mm-hmm. And here's the record, here's what the various children say happened, this is what Joan said, this is what they congratulated him at his victory, how things look different now, we take a different view about allegations of, but maybe we take too exaggerated a view. I mean, I didn't put that in, but I mean, I don't know. I can only put the facts there. And I can't even say leave the reader to make up their mind. It doesn't, no, I don't feel as a biographer I have any duty to go beyond the facts.
Right.
I feel I should have to work very hard and stay at Holiday Inns and go to libraries and strange places. To get any possible fact, and if you've got a clipping, you know, a cutting from some newspaper of 1917 or something nobody else has seen, that's absolutely, you know, I think that's fact, though I suppose they weren't always accurate. But just get together all you can and make my, I left the reader, I think he probably was guilty as charged, mm-hmm. but you can't, his profession forgave him,
right.
The law forgave him. And what more can I do?
Yeah. No, you've passed the verdict on to the reader.
Yeah, but again, there isn't any verdict to be, you know, reached.
The judgment.
You just have this, but then you judge it against his later life. And it was an enormous achievement, hard work, wonderful achievement.
Right.
No more of this trouble. So sometimes people do cure themselves. I think now we tend to think all kind of child sex and all that is incurable, and yet there must be some people that get over it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think in his case, he may have done. His first wife, fascinating person, national heroine in Wales, is Morvith Owen, was the most beautiful and most gifted composer Wales has ever produced. And Jones proposed to her after their second meeting, and they married very quickly. I think it was 1917, and they had, well, what some say was a troubled year of marriage, but anyway, at the end of it, they were in holiday in Wales, and she came down visiting his parents. She came down with appendicitis, and there was an operation, and I think, as was done in those times, and it was in the middle of the First World War, I suspect it happened on the kitchen table. Anyway, she died, and The name of the doctor who was there, it certainly wasn't Jones. A doctor came in and signed the death certificate. I would be very surprised if Jones hadn't acted as the anesthetist. Things being what the whole the tea strainer and whatever they did in those days. Anyway, rumor, and then, of course, Ali, by then he was an analyst, and Joan Revere and all these other people said, you know, you must feel very guilty about your wife's death. And he was obviously very relieved also to get out of what was being a troubled marriage. So they had an analytic feast over the circumstances. But what actually happened, she had, I think it was peritonitis following appendectomy, and you just can't, without knowing, she certainly wasn't, the operation I don't think took place, the death wasn't in a hall. I collect the certificates, that's a great hobby of biographers, you get all the certificates. Anyway, she died at home, not in a hospital. But again, this is 1917, it was in the depths of the First World War, and nothing was really working very well. So, you know, if you were writing it in fiction, you could have him just putting a few extra drops in the anesthetic mix and having him ridding himself of a troubled wife. But anyway, she's a heroine in Wales, and there were pilgrimages every year to her grave. So she's not forgotten, and very beautiful if you see any of the pictures.
And all the evidence is very ambiguous, isn't it?
Well, the evidence, well, God knows. Look at read the papers today. Yeah, I mean, yeah. The evidence is ambiguous unless you have a very clear-cut thing. You don't know. And as a biographer, I don't feel it's my job to decide. I can just tell you as much as I can find out and try to show how the rest of the life played itself out.
But you know, I wonder whether the one of the things that comes out of the biography is that at certain points Jones acted in ways which were maybe tactless or not very sensible and thought he could get away with it. I mean, this was having been pulled up before the courts, whatever happened, whether he exhibited himself and masturbated onto the table, whatever happened, he then took upon himself to talk in sexual terms with other children at a later hospital. Now, however one looks at it, it's at least dangerous in the climate he was in and with the reputation he had. And he seems to have felt he could get away with it.
Well, I think he did feel he could get away with it, but as I said, it's hindsight. I mean, what he got, certainly the second occasion didn't seem to me as damaging in the first, in which there were stains on a green baize tablecloth which were of such a nature as they should not have been there. But there's no DNA, we don't know, anyway. But the second time he was accused of talking about sexual matters with a child, but he was by then a psychoanalyst for 10 years.
Without a chaperone.
But the door was open. The door was open. And the fact is, nobody talked about sex in those days. And so if he asked her if she masturbated or slept with her brother or whatever, I mean, that would have been so, or whatever they would talk about, it would have been so shocking even to enter those regions of conversation.
Yeah, I mean, he hadn't been an analyst for that length. This is before he went off to Toronto.
No, this is the second. Oh, yeah, you're right. The first thing, sorry. Yeah.
It's fairly close, actually, to the first occurrence. It strikes me that there is that side to him, which comes across in when colleagues talk about him. He could be very omnipotent and autocratic.
Yes, yes, he was.
He could get away with things.
Yeah.
And got caught out.
Yeah. And of course, as his portrait up there shows, you know, in the end prevailed and survived to look down on all of us.
Thank you. There are a couple of things that I want to say, but it... I hope it just doesn't sound too much like pure admiration.
Go ahead. Say whatever comes into your head.
No, I loved the book. I enjoyed so many aspects of it, and I just want to touch on a couple of things because of something that you have said now that provoked more ideas in me. I really had not appreciated what an important person he was, despite my training and analysis, etc. I shall admit my ignorance. And so I'll come back to that point about his name. you've sort of half said what I had been thinking reading your book before I read it. I had no doubt in my mind that he was guilty of something with those little girls, you know, from the snippets that I had heard. To get accused in England and then to get accused in Canada, too much of a coincidence. I thought you wrote beautifully about it, just as you said, putting the facts before us. But I think it wasn't just the facts of the case. What I've told people, I've recommended the book, I said, what I found reading the book was, despite having been told about repression of sexuality in those days and comparing it to now, I thought you conveyed that so well in terms of the cultural context. I can't remember the exact quote. I often tell people about you having written about how when they were performing plays in the theatre, you know, it was considered an obscenity to mention some piece of underwear of a woman. You know, you've brought forward...
Oh, that was the Irish play. That was a thing. That was a thing.
Yeah, that right.
The shift. Caused a riot, yes.
You know, that kind of description of the context, I think, was so important in writing about what was happening at the time. And I'll focus particularly on those two things, his behavior with the little girls and all the relationships of the analysts to each other. You know, that in modern day, now we would think a bit scandalous, you know, the whole question of using the transference, you know, the influence that various analysts had over their analysands, right through to sexuality. And I thought that was beautifully done and not scandalous in the way that you had transported us back to the time. Regarding going back to the little girls, what struck me about it is what you've started to speak about. I thought, there's that, you know, arrogance that comes through in his early days, and him going in there. What I started to think was, he was overstepping the mark, perhaps in speech, and you know, one can be very abusive in being over-sexualized in speech, even now with children, but think of it at the time, and that what he was doing probably was shocking, dreadful, his own arrogance, that he overstepped the mark. It doesn't have the feel of a paedophile as such, and you've conveyed so well his rather exuberant interest in sexuality, that I think in his arrogance, you know, he was actually traumatizing these children. But the other thing that struck me just while you were talking was the name Jones. And, you know, I'm impressed by what you're saying, but I'm thinking, well, maybe that was part of his skill, that he, in a sense, the fact that he didn't take the grand name, the double-barreled name, and maybe it's Welshness, I don't know, but I certainly know a little about the Irishness and how to be successful, you know, in getting something done without putting yourself forward and making yourself big. And I wonder how many institutions are crushed by the ambitions of those who led it, the charismatic leaders who actually are more interested in becoming big themselves, where he had that facility that may have been called duplicity to a degree, but of knowing when to step back and to actually get the job done. And that the naming issue was part of that, that it was in keeping with actually not aggrandizing himself, but making sure, I mean, he did, obviously, he wanted to be recognized, but another part of him was able to stand back and facilitate people coming together, you know, for the sake of making the Institute great.
Very well put. Thank you for all that. I can't really add to it.
I, too, immensely enjoyed reading the book. I thought it was a wonderful book. And the way you put it, the duplicitousness or the fact that Jones had the capacity to look two ways, it almost sounded as if the context you put it into, that he it was due to Jones that the British society did not split into two, because Jones would say to Melanie Klein, oh, that Anna Freud, and then to Anna Freud, oh, that Melanie Klein. And his capacity, really, to have double allegiance, I think, stood the British society in good stead.
Oh, that's interesting. I hadn't thought of it that way.
I think, unfortunately, he withdrew from those discussions a good deal.
Did he? Yeah.
And I think it was people like Sylvia Payne who held it together much more, who then became, of course, the president.
Oh, yes.
And she, as you say in your book, she and Rickman, for example, saw the necessity to place psychoanalysis in relation to other disciplines in a way that Jones wouldn't. I mean, he would do it through his writing on Hamlet and so on, but he would not have people work at the Tavi, for example, if they were psychoanalysts. It was banned. They couldn't do it. And it was only in those war years with Rickman and Bion and so on that one got that movement. So, I mean, I think you're right. He was incredibly strong. He also limited psychoanalysis in certain respects by the sort of strength he had. So he wanted to keep it so pure.
Well, that's true, because by the wartime, he had really retreated to Sussex
And of course, he was bombed out in London, wasn't he?
But anyway, there was a lovely place down there. Yeah. And so in a way, he'd left the battle to them. And then didn't want to get into those controversial discussions. Mm. But I think he did also certainly help to hold them together. Mm.
But when Siobhan was talking, I was reminded of his smallness as a man and what he felt about that.
He didn't actually mention it, but that was the thing, because it strikes you all the time, especially with these tall Bloomsbury types falling for him. You know, he was 5'4". I mean, he was smaller than almost all of them, except maybe Anna, probably smaller even than Freud. And he never referred to it particularly. I mean,
in his passport.
Oh, his passport, did I have him a couple inches?
He was economical with the facts in his passport, wasn't he? he said he was 5'6".
I found that upstairs. Thank you very much.
That's right,
I think he would have liked to have been taller, but it didn't seem to be an enormous handicap, and he certainly didn't go on about it.
Though the one thing he would have liked to have written about was Napoleon. And didn't, for some
reason. I didn't do that.
I mean, I have the impression, actually, that his body, his size, his body image is very important in the character of the man.
Just slightly off that topic, but I was intrigued by the fact that Jones, with both of his marriages, entered into them with startling rapidity. Within a couple of meetings of both, he'd made the decision that he was going to marry these women. I was just wondering what you read into that, particularly given his reputation prior to that, I guess as something of a ladies' man.
Well, he obviously did trust his instinct. I mean, wasn't it, it's in the book, but when his son got married, got proposed to somebody, you know, after 2 months or something, and he said, you know, you've wasted a lot of time. I mean, why not get on with it? And I think whatever you think about him, he certainly made up his mind very quickly. And then also perhaps because of his previous troubles, he really did want to get married and settle down. And the second time, actually friends were helping, but I mean, the second legal marriage, actually the Austrian Jewish lady who helped him with his with all his biography work, this was the perfect marriage, and he wasn't going to wait, but it is just one of the comics. I mean, also especially going with his smallness, you know, and he sees a woman, and all of them were bigger than he was. Now, you, yeah. And you can't help be beguiled by somebody who is just that sure of himself.
Though, you know, I think there may be parallels in other parts of his life, because he seems to have the impulse to do something and then not to be quite able to think about the consequences. I mean, for example, in 1913 he starts this society, And he starts it at exactly the time when there are ructions within between Jung and Freud. And then he finds that it has to break up because there are too many Jungians in amongst the people he's chosen, Ida particularly. And then it becomes defunct, more or less, and he reforms it and gets rid of all the Jungians in 1919. It's very odd for somebody who is so politically powerful and can insert himself into things that he couldn't think that through. No, that might be hindsight.
Yeah, but I mean, what can you say? That was the whole thing. Everybody's mind was obliterated by the First World War. By 1919, where were the Jungians?
No, but I'm talking about 1913, when he forms
the society.
It really is not a good idea to do what he does at that point, if he could have thought it through. I mean, Ida was already publishing on Jung.
Yes.
Constance Long, who was one of the other leading figures, was already interested in Jung. Jung was staying with her in London before the society was formed in 1913.
Ida was a good friend of D.H. Lawrence.
He couldn't think it through. He had the idea and he had to go.
Yes, well, that he certainly did that with everything. But certainly as far as starting the journal and writing the biographies, he just did it. The biography took a long time. He didn't do it just like that, but he agreed what he wanted to do, and he carried it out.
Can I just ask about your interaction with the son, Mervyn Jones? How did that?
Did he feel happy that you were turning up asking questions?
And yes, he said, maybe in the spirit of his father, he didn't like Vincent Broome's biographies. That was a rotten book. Mm-hmm. And he thought another book needed to be done. Mm-hmm. And so I saw him 3 or 4 times in his nursing home. But I didn't get much out of him. I mean, it was a pleasure just to see him. See how much of the personality survived, but he's in his 80s in a very bad way. But his granddaughter Jackie, she was exceedingly helpful, and they gave me permission for all the pictures and things, which, as I know from my other books, isn't always automatic. You can have a lot of troubles. But I wished I'd known him. I mean,
did he give you the story about Freud living in Wales or visiting Wales?
No, that I got from Paul Ferris, a friend of mine who wrote a biography of Freud. Uh-huh. Paul Ferris is also from Wales, which tells you people with Welsh connections stick together. And Paul put that in his biography of Freud, that when he went to visit this village and in on the Gower Peninsula, and then this man said, as they will in the pub, does the name Freud mean anything to you? And Mervyn Jones said, yes. And he said, you might like to know he died in this very village. But anyway, it was very moving to me to see in the churchyard there, we went to see this plaque saying, is Sigmund Freud is his disciple. And Jones's name is above and Freud's an afterthought. So I think that's the closest Freud ever got to Wales.
There's a lovely film in the archives of the 75th anniversary of the society, and Mervyn speaks of that.
Oh, does he?
And he tells that story.
Oh, does he?
Yes,
oh,
wonderful.
I didn't know that. I have to change the footnote. That's where Paul. I didn't see the film. Maybe that's where Paul Ferris got it. Very good.
I still saw.
Oh yeah.
Yes. Kid meetings and so on. So I knew what he looked like. And I don't know whether you were told this, but I went to an international congress, and I'm trying to work it out, in Paris. And I think it was 57, because they're odd, aren't they?
Yeah. It was his last one, I think.
And Jones spoke. And he got up, and he had a Freud beard.
Oh, yes, I think there's a picture of him. I think that
it was very startling, because having seen him with
yes,
you know,
yes,
always clean
yes.
shaven up to then. So I think, following Ken, his appearance was very significant to him.
Yes, yes, he was vain.
And, you know, that his smallness, you get a feeling of really quite a vain man.
Small but dapper.
Yes, dapper, yes.
He didn't
and trying to, in that way, make up for that smallness. Mm. I've got a feeling it's probably more important than Welshness.
My favorite illustration in the book is the one I got from The History of Life of Lloyd George. I said, two type Welsh types, there's a small type and a big type. Yeah. Here's the small type.
I just wanted to say that I'm looking forward to reading the Ernest Jones biography. I read your Rosalind Franklin biography after we heard you speak at Cheltenham, which was very interesting. And it kind of strikes me, hearing you talk about Ernest Jones now, that in a sense there is some similarity with Rosalind Franklin again about the kind of people who like to get things done. You know, the people who are perhaps more concerned with the work in some ways, with making sure that what they're passionate about is solidly underpinned by the work that they do. Mm-hmm. And that maybe, you know, the Crick Watson romantic chances, in a way, you know, have to have this solid underpinning before they can do the work they do. In a sense, there's a real combination between the workers and the dreamers. In a sense, you can't have one without the other. And this is, you know, in that context, a tremendous shame that she wasn't acknowledged at the time for what was truly wonderful work. But anyway, I look forward to exploring Ernest Jones and getting the same interest.
She was a bit more serious than he was, I think.
She was certainly very serious, yes.
Thank you.
But fascinating nonetheless.
Just following on from that, I was wondering how you decide on the subjects you're going to write about.
As I said, I usually look for a good story. It's just Nora Joyce, I wrote when I finished Richard Ellman's monumental biography, like 800 pages, and I thought, I wanted to know more about Nora. She was called Our Lady of the Footnote. So she made any joke who was put down in the footnote, and I thought I could rescue her from those footnotes, which I did. And certainly Lawrence, or letters, seven volumes of letters have just been published. Letters are wonderful. And Yeats, he and his wife believed they did magic writing, communicating with spirits, and some academics in Florida, God bless their souls, published in three or four volumes this whole loony correspondence. If you saw the real letters, you couldn't read it. But anyway, they printed this out, and it was just such a revelation of a marriage, of a husband and wife talking to each other through this kind of, and then what they each believed was a ghostly hand. That was irresistible. I couldn't realize. I mean, it was just an elaborate exercise in family planning. The ghost would say, next Tuesday, without fail, you know. And then once they had the desired son, the ghostly writing stopped. It was too good a story with new material. So that's how. And Jones is Andrew Paskoskas from Canada has done the Jones Freud letters. And then when you've got them, and then you can see the jokes or the things they say to each other, and that's the real reason. I picked it.
Yes, I find this fascinating because I don't know very much about Ernest Jones, and I was wondering if I could ask a sort of a general question, ask you to expand on something, as I'd like to take up something we haven't really talked much about so far, namely his scientific contributions. And he did write quite extensively, some of his papers are still read and used for teaching purposes now. And I was wondering if you could put together for us what you know about the man with ideas that he developed in psychoanalysis and papers that he published, the context in which he would maybe have written some of the papers. We've talked quite a lot about his psychopathology tonight, but the way he tried to work his way through it. But you may have your own views about how that also contributed to his scientific contributions.
Well, probably others in the room are better qualified to answer than I am. He said to Freud, and I'm no great theoretician. what he was, but I thought Freud was surrounded by theoreticians. I mean, they all had, Adler had his views, oh, it really works this way and you work that way. Jones didn't come up with any new idea of how the mind or the unconscious worked or even how any improvements in analytic technique. It seemed to me what he did was put Freud's ideas into very clear, readable English. The Hamlet and Oedipus I can never remember the names of all these papers, but they're all exceedingly readable. I mean, I remember the ones I like, but I remember The Island of Ireland. He said it all there. I mean, why is Ireland so different from Britain? They've got this feminine cult, the cult of the Virgin, the cult of the Dark Rosaline, and he traces it through. Very learned, and it just actually makes sense that these two cultures actually really had this enormous gap between them, and he put it as clearly as I could imagine anyone doing. And then I do like, of course, his paper on the Welsh and the Jews, and the characteristics they have in common, the great respect for education, and having acquired surnames under unfortunate circumstances. It seems to me he was, you know yourself, but which of his theoretical papers make most sense to you, but I just think, as a writer, I admire him as a writer. He expressed himself so clearly, and also with vast scholarship. I mean, he had read everything, and so there were just wonderful allusions. The symbolism of some people think is his, I can't quote it all to you, but exactly what a symbol is. His paper on the nightmare. He realized, he said, oh yeah, that's right, that's what it is. That's what I say in the book. Sylvia Plath gave it to Ted Hughes in that first Christmas present. This dark creature who comes in the night and sits on your chest and takes away, you know, this feeling of oppression. It's just the best description of a nightmare I've ever read. You might say it's no theoretical contribution and no way to cure yourself of them, but my heavens, the words are all perfect, and that's what I admire. But maybe other practitioners have, maybe they've learned something from Jones in terms of treating people.
There was even one of the inspiration behind Christopher Freiling's exhibition on the Gothic.
Uh-huh. Was it? Uh-huh. Was it? Was it? I didn't know that. Yeah.
Well, I think it's a very interesting question from Don, because, you know, it may be one of the points at which Jones is independent of Freud more than we think that he is. I mean, on female sexuality, for example, he parts company with Freud, and Freud knew that, but he wasn't afraid to do it. And that seems to me, in a way, quite remarkable, just as he parted company by really being more interested in Melanie Klein than Anna Freud. And he didn't back off either when Freud took him to task for it. He stuck on in there. Yeah. So I think he was quite an independent thinker in his own way. And this, which is interesting, isn't it? Because, I mean, he was very good at getting people to talk together. And I don't think he liked conflict all that much, actually. One might have thought that he would tend to curry favor with Freud rather than be independent of him. But it's very interesting.
He also, I have the feeling, observed his own young children much more closely than Freud did.
Uh-huh.
Freud's, you know, his wife had the baby every year, and other than he was away doing his thing, but I don't think he really got very involved in weaning or feeding or what to do when they woke up in the night, and Jones knew all that. But I haven't answered your question, but maybe somebody else can. I don't know what his theoretical contributions are, and I've asked myself, and I can't.
I used to know Mervyn Jones very well, in fact, when we lived in London, because we were both writers. Would he say, and the last time I visited him in Brighton was a long time ago, and he was frail then. The question I want to ask is whether he feels he owes anything of his own writing to his father, or whether he owed, or what he feels he does owe him.
I didn't ask him that, I give you his address, and I'm sure he'd be happy to hear from you. I was very moved by the letter that Jones wrote to his son when Mervyn's first novel came out, saying, "You have chosen the right profession." Jones did admire the fact that his son was a real creative writer, could write fiction. journalism and all that, and his father certainly appreciated it very much. He didn't say too much about him, and nor did the other son, Lewis Jones, whom I talked to also.
You've painted a very vivid picture of how in some ways Jones was an outsider, and yet in many ways I think he was president for I don't know how long, but many terms. He more or less kind of hung on as a kind of central insider in terms of this society, and you can see that there's something in his character to bring together contradictions. And that might be the contradictions of some of his, his personality, his tremendous kind of gift of clarity and some of his scientific ability, but also some rather kind of peculiar personal areas, vanity and, some stray sexuality. I suppose, but one of the things that, this sort of central question, whether he in some way really overstepped the mark is something that kind of lies around, about the facts of what happened in that early case with children. And, I'm sorry I haven't read your book yet to go through the your version of the details, but in some ways, and I can quite see the issue, as Siobhan was putting it, in terms of misuse of language and inappropriate and intrusive kind of verbal contact with children, which would highly disturb them. And I can see that. But the issue of whether there was something seriously pedophilic is a crucial one, really. When you think of other figures, and they do occur. They are there in analysis, like Masood Khan. Where there'd been serious, perverse behaviour that's come out with patients that have brought his work and brought many around him and, people in this society into disrepute, about their complicity with it. It's a much more serious issue with Jones. Of course, it's kind of a bit buried in history. And so it's difficult to get to it. But I suppose as a biographer, I wondered whether you actually came across other examples, insinuations, really, that might point in that direction. So, for example, I would think, if my contact, in dealing with people with severe perversions, that it would come out in different ways. It may come out at a later time, and so on. Now, he led, he was a psychoanalyst in very turbulent, creative early days. And I was thinking of his analysis of Joan Revere, actually, a very, very creative analyst, but a very disturbed personality as well, and who had all kinds of delusions about what Jones was doing to him, to her. I just wondered, whether you were left with a sense or an impression that could tell us anything on that, about, whether there were other areas and one was left with doubts and suspicions, which is maybe all we might be able to access at this point, or whether, that there just wasn't in that way.
Well, I've laid it all out in the book, and all the child issues are in chapter 4. As I said, I found no evidence whatsoever that once he got back to London and got on his feet, that there was any ever of that trouble again. Certainly, and by the time he was fully professionally active in London, president of the International, editor of the Journal, happily married, small children. It's just, people would have been watching him. I think psychoanalysis was a bolt hole from the world in which he'd failed, from one way or another. And maybe, as he's told Freud, psychoanalysis actually helped him cure certain wrong tendencies in myself. It does work sometimes. And I think he worked out how what it was in himself, and he got, being a practical man, got rid of it. But I can't go beyond the facts. I said, you hear about the stains on the tablecloth. Well, you know, imagine how long it would take for DNA to say, you know, was it left over from the tea? I mean, it's, you know, whose was it? Or if it was a person. You know, it just, we're 100 years on now, and we just have to take the world as we find it, and as we know, there's mysteries we can't solve today, and you just take what evidence you can, but you don't get the answer you want. And I can just say, I like to think he actually cured himself. But that's one of the things why psychoanalysis was such a, it worked for him. And so he did, was able to cure this total wrong direction his life was heading in, and then create a world, and then look, he turned and makes himself the boss of it, and even better. That's how I see it. There wasn't any other, he didn't have any other professional speciality he could have gone into except analysis.
Could I suggest, purely from reading your book, that my own impression was, and picking up what Dennis is saying, that it doesn't come across so much as a perversion as an over-interest, rather, you know, he was a bit sex-starved, and the cure was not so much the analysis as being in a very satisfying relationship with an attractive, very, you know, that it was actually more to do with that. I mean, the whole area of sexuality was obviously very important. And it would have a different connotation. Okay, some analysis helped, conflicts, whatever. But I think that's the feeling I get from the character that you portray, because otherwise, in terms of perversion, you know, it doesn't fit with a paedophile. That was my impression.
Well, I forget the chronology, but I do believe by the time he got into that child scandal was just before, or just after he'd taken up with Lo Kahn, this gorgeous, wonderful, thank you for the picture from the Freud Museum, woman. So he wasn't doing without ordinary sexual outlet. I don't think he was, it wasn't frustration that got him into trouble in Deptford.
But one thing that does come out, and you bring out, is that he felt, or at least some women felt, Vaughan Sawyer, for example, that he had a sort of magnetic attraction, and that he understood them, and this was very seductive. And I certainly have a sense of him being rather vain. It may be going again with his sense of his size and so on, but being a rather vain man who really felt he was rather good with the ladies. And there is in the archives a rather odd series of documents by Claude Danger Daly, who was a
Book.
He's the man from the Indian Army who was referred to Shell Shock.
And
Jones treats him, and this is a dream diary, so it's a bit difficult to evaluate what's from a dream and what's association and what one can trust. But certainly he talks about sessions in which he would actually tease Jones about not being attractive to women, and he said Jones got very, very angry with him.
There's another historical fiction which is made fun of by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World, where he has all the children having sex behind the bushes. Mm-hmm. And that was a takeoff on analysis as it was perceived, which was that at that time, and I think Anna Freud...
Not a progressive education, a kind of...
No, Anna Freud, it's mentioned somewhere specifically that they made a mistake in thinking that all you had to do was to liberate children sexually, and then they wouldn't develop neuroses. And they actually acted on it, I think, in some ways. So, you know, and it was only later that they discovered it didn't work and so on. But I think that was the atmosphere, maybe in that 1913.
No, I know people felt that way about progressive education, the schools with children, nude bathing and all that.
Yes, and I also heard a very lovely Viennese, Willy Hoffer, told the story that he went to see a boy in his home, in a working class home, and because he couldn't leave home to go to school. And he was about 7, I think, or something. And when he left that place, the children called after him, "Oh, there goes the man who talks dirty to little Hans."
Oh, yes.
So, you know, it was very much...
That's true.
These were charges that came up in the BMA inquiry. They don't get put into the final report, but they're there in the documents of the recordings of the meetings. And certainly, yes, the psychoanalysts go into schools and they corrupt the children.
But then BMA passed psychoanalysis and Jones wrote the report.
But he had, and he argued about this with them in order to write the report.
Well, it was just to remind you that he did claim to have lost his virginity at the age of 8, didn't he? To put that
it was
in your
five.
Book.
Wasn't that 5 or 6?
Which I thought was quite a shocking fact.
And also to put that on the first pages of your autobiography when you are.
Ending in a whiff of scandal, I think.
No, it's a whiff of being Welsh.
To revert to the beginning, I did forget one instruction, quite a pleasant one, but working now with a journalist in a glass of wine here this morning. Thank you very much.
Thank you. We will enjoy it. Thank you.
Very connected conversations.